We open Fresh Air today with a 1929 Tiny Parham recording of Stompin' On Down. Every Monday on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we feature the series Eileen Farrell and the American Popular Singers, today part two of Bobby Short's guest appearance. Fresh Air's arts reviewer Judy Stein will be with us at 3:40 for her weekly review of museum and gallery shows. At 3:30, Dan Lusk reviews another publication from the Small Literary Press on Off the Wall. Photographer Danny Lyon has traveled around the United States and Latin America for two decades with his camera, documenting the civil rights movement, motorcycle culture, the Texas prison system, abandoned street children, and Manhattan subways. His first major museum exhibition opens this Saturday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Danny Lyon will be with us in about a half hour on Fresh Air. With me is John Malloy, who's the author of the best-selling books Dress for Success, The Woman's Dress for Success book, and a new one called Malloy's Live for Success. His books are manuals designed to teach you how to look successful on the premise that then successful people will think that you look successful and will kind of welcome you into their club, making it possible for you to become successful. Live for Success has chapters on power, friendship, office politics, how to behave when dining, correct behavior for your spouse at business functions, and how to communicate the appropriate socioeconomic level. John Malloy, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
Am I right in the way I got it that if you communicate the appearance of success, then you're more apt to achieve success?
That's correct. Not only will successful people respond more positively to you, everyone will. You see, we all turn on the same television and see the same tube, and we see the same people represented as power figures on the air. For example, I would ask the audience to close their eyes and to picture the vice president of a major corporation. In fact, I'll ask you, is he wearing a suit, yes or no?
Yes.
Dark or light?
Dark.
Two-piece or three-piece?
Oh, a three-piece, I think.
Right, okay, you'll go with about 75 and three. Color of his shirt?
Light blue.
That's unusual. Most people say white, but that's...
This is an avant-garde banker.
Hey, but the point is most people will, 80-90% will give identical answers, including white shirt. Light blue is your second choice. But you won't get anybody picturing anyone in a striped pink shirt. It just doesn't work that way. We have a preconceived notion of what a powerful person looks like. Now I'm going to ask you a question which is even more interesting. I want you to assume that next to this banker is next to this very successful banker, a man of background and breeding, is someone who was brought up in the toughest section of this town. Nice fellow, but sort of rough. Picture their faces. Do you see two different people? Let me describe the people, and you can tell me whether I'm accurate. What most people see with the man successful is a man who's slightly thinner, has what they would call a refined or distant or an aloof look about him, delicate features, means he holds his facial muscles differently. And in the other man, they see someone with gruff or what would be called macho in the toughest area town look on his face, because that's what he was taught he was supposed to do. His shoulders might be a little bit more rolled, and we would expect them also to speak differently, and they probably would. Their verbal patterns would be different. They'd use a different vocabulary. Now, if you can look like the first man and not the second, you have a much better chance of being hired on almost any corporation anywhere. People will think you're brighter than you are. And vice versa. And they won't think you as bright as you look the second way. Now, I come from a blue-collar background, so I certainly do not have the prejudice that people from other backgrounds are brighter. I don't think they are. But there is an advantage to looking bright, competent, articulate, clever, and intelligent, and that's really what I teach people to do.
The person in the bank I was imagining as being kind of paunchy, with a certain tension in the face also from having to deal with a lot of difficult administrative
problems.
Okay,
well, you're picturing someone who's 50-ish then, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah, 40s okay. or 50s,
well,
I guess.
I pictured two younger people. That was simply a matter of judgment. But the fact is, most of the time, if you ask, you say there's someone with money and without, they'll pick the person with money as being thinner.
Really?
Generally. But the fact is, it isn't critical that we pick specifics. What is critical is the weight is one of the things I point out, although most people pick it that way. The critical fact is how you hold your body and how you hold your facial muscles. Right now, there are people out there teaching their children to look like failures, and they're simply doing it by looking at them.
What are the facial muscles?
Okay. Well, the way the upper middle class hold their facial muscles is they tend to hold their lips tighter together. They don't sit with their mouth open. The men have their shoulders further back, and the women have their head higher in the air. You know the picture of the woman walking with a book on her head? Well, anyone out there who doesn't want to buy my book, who just wants to do it on their own, get yourself another book, any book, and put it on your head.
Finishing school posture. Right?
That's what my book should be called. It should be called The Finishing School for the American Elite.
You know what I noticed about the Malloy's Live for Success book? That your image of the successful person seems to be... I should preface this by saying that this interview is going to be filled with everybody's stereotypes about what certain types of groups of people look like. Because we're talking, I mean, I'm going to give you my image of the successful person and that stereotype, and you'll be giving us yours. So we'll be dealing with a lot of generalizations, I'm sure. So, but it seems that the image of success that you're offering is the image of the type of family who has had money for many, many years. In other words, not a wealthy person who just earned a lot of money during their generation,
basically,
or even during their parents' generation, but a family where the money goes back for many, many years.
Basically, you're right, because what we found is most of the people who run America come from those families, and that is the stereotype image of success and power in America. If you'll take a look at Congress, you know, you think of the Democrats as being more liberal than Republicans, but there are more Democratic millionaires than there are Republican millionaires. And they're not men who made their million. They're men who inherited their millions from daddy, who may have inherited it from granddad. So the fact, you know, it's just the statistical fact that people from such backgrounds run America, tend to be corporate presidents and corporate vice presidents and partners in major accounting firms, and their sons also and daughters will be also. Therefore, all I'm doing is reporting a reality.
Mm-hmm. I guess, are there some professions where the people at the top are different?
Oh, yes. If you're a blue-collar worker's son and you want to go up, the best field to go into is engineering or science. Because in engineering, if your computer chip does what someone else's doesn't, it doesn't make any difference. You stand on your head. And if your rocket falls in the ocean and the other fellas goes over the moon, it's the fellas who goes over the moon. But if you go into an area where judgmental value is very important, then where you're going to be judged. By the way, even engineers will do better if they have upper-middle-class habits, because the keys to being a top engineer is to stop engineering and to become a manager, and the elements that make it easy for people to be successful managers are the same ones I'm describing. What I really talk about, though, I'd like to back it up. First of all, let me tell you that basically John Malloy is not giving his opinion. In fact, I'm not giving it at all. We interviewed 2,000 successful men and women. We said to them, what does it? I went through the first 60 or so, and I said, God, this is going to be a dull book. Oh, my God. They kept giving me, put your nose to the grindstone, sweat, perspiration. I said, it can't be that bad. I don't want to do it then. And I got to a friend of mine, and he gave me this nose to the grindstone bit, and I said, wait a second. I know you work hard, but it's me you're talking to. And he said, John, if I tell you the truth, will you print it? He says, that's why I can't tell you. So I went over to a typewriter, and I typed out, I will pay you $10,000 if I reveal anything you told me here today. And he said, oh, in that case. And then we got this is really an insider's view of how to get ahead. For example, you know, almost everyone we talked to immediately said, I went to them, I said, does young people come to you looking for jobs all the time or looking for promotions? Does any one thing turn you off about them? And they all said, no, of course not, certainly not. I got to a woman I knew for years, again, a friend. And when I went to her, I said, did anyone ever come in here? And I put my finger across my throat and made that sign, said, cut their throat in 5 minutes. She said, oh, my God, did they? The other day, I had this young fella come in. I was going to hire him as my assistant. I took him to lunch, and he ate with his mouth open. Yuck. When Peck and I asked the other executives, did anyone turn you off on one occasion, and over half of them said yes at table. So the criteria, the importance of table manners is absolutely critical. And I'll tell you, by the way, if you are brought up in a home where table manners weren't pounded into you, you're going to have to tonight get your full place setting. If you don't know, get my book. It'll show you how to do it and practice. And never mind your practicing, your children should practice. And they have to at least eat 3 formal meals a week for 6 months and be brought up to task if they're doing it wrong or chewing with their mouth open or breaking the rules. Because unless they learn to do it automatically, when they're under the pressure of a job interview, they're going to fall apart. The second thing I tell people out there is, even if you were brought up in a home where table manners were part of your upbringing and you have no fear of doing it wrong, if you're divorced, you may be. We found one of the main reasons for poor table manners was divorce. We went into one company and recently I've been speaking to companies all over the country on giving these after-dinner speeches on table manners. I hate it. I mean, it's sort of boring. But I keep getting these offers. So I told one company, I said, look, I don't want to do it. I'm not an entertainer. I know you have an entertaining speech, but I'm not an entertainer. I don't want to be an entertainer. Only if it helps your people will I do it. So you have to look at them in the executive dining room, judge them on a 1 to 10 basis. I give the speech and do the same thing 6 months later and see if I helped everyone. Well, I did that with several companies. First of all, there was a lot of improvement. But the most astounding thing is some people who were 8s went down to being 3s. And I said, what did they have in common? And the thing they had in common is they were divorced or they ate in front of television sets all the time. They forgot that, you know, they're so used to eating without people that they shove things in their mouth, pick up their potatoes with their fingers. And then when they get into a situation where it isn't suitable, they forget themselves and they do it anyway. So if you've just gotten a divorce, don't eat in front of the TV set. Eat in front of a mirror. It is very, 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 very unusual finding. By the way, if you've once had good table manners, they come back to you rather easily. If you've never had them, I'm giving you a job that's going to take you a full year.
How did you learn?
I learned as a child. My grandmother beat me.
No.
Oh, yes. She would absolutely rap your knuckles if you didn't do it correctly. She didn't play around. She was basic, old-fashioned Irish.
Let's get back to the image of the kind of person that you're suggesting we emulate on our way to success. Since we've established that the image of the person is an upper middle class, and I'd assume white male also.
Oh, no, not necessarily white male.
Uh-huh.
It's also female. But it tends to be, it doesn't tend to be white either. No.
For people who are black, Spanish-speaking, female, ethnic, who are the models?
Well, let's start with Martin Luther King. Upper middle class, great verbal patterns, carried himself like an upper middle class person. If you take most of the black leaders in America, they don't speak ghetto English. They have nice possible sentences. Their vocabulary is extensive, and they are as adept at a table as anyone else. In fact, among black middle class people, table manners are stressed even more strictly than they are white middle class people, possibly because blacks have such a tenuous hold on being middle class that they absolutely insist on it with their children.
You say that theoretically everyone has 2 socioeconomic levels. What are the 2 levels?
The 2 is the real one, the perceived one. Let's assume that you have $50 million. No, let's assume I have $50 million. Heck with you. And I live in a small town, and I own the only business in town, the only gas station in town, the only restaurant in town, and I own all the homes everyone lives in. Let's make me a real land baron. Well, I can dress in anything I want. I can eat with my mouth open or closed. I can lay in the gutter. Nobody's really going to get very annoyed with me because I own the place. Or to be more realistic, let's assume I live in a small town and I own a very good business. How I dress really won't impact the way people treat me. They know who I am. But if I move into the larger world where power lies, New York, Washington, Philadelphia, you know, where you don't know everyone you meet. Well, then we have an apparent level and a real level of power. Let us assume that there's 2 John Malloys, John Malloy and his twin brother. We are physically identical. We have the exact same job, whatever that job happens to be. And we are both equally talented or lacking in talent. And we'll even match us up. We're married to identical twins, so you can't tell them apart. And we both go to a restaurant on the same night. Now, the first John Malloy walks in and says, you like to have beer? and he's dressed in his polyester leisure suit, and they stick him by the kitchen door. He orders a steak dinner, and they sort of throw it at him. And they charge him the same money they serve the second John boy, who walks in and says, "Yes, I would like a table." And he's dressed in a three-piece pinstripe suit. And they put him at a good table with his wife, and they're a little bit more polite to him. And he pays the same amount for his food, mind you. He may even get a better cut of food. And he has a much more pleasant evening than man one. Now, you may say, well, it's nice to get a good seat in a restaurant, but is it that important? Let's take the two John Malloys, both with the same educational background, the same work background, and put them into an interview situation. We have a section of the book on how to take an interview, which I think is the most important interview book ever written, in my opinion. I know it may sound egotistical, but I think it is. Because we research what interviewers were looking for. You know what they said? They said, what we're looking for is someone who is self-assured and dynamic. And I said, wait a second, fella. What are you really looking for? Well, that's what I'm looking for. So we took photographs, we took videotapes of people who are high school dropouts from upper middle class areas. And then we videotaped people who are very successful from very limited backgrounds. And they were all white because we didn't want a racial variable in there. And we showed these pictures to people, and they were dressed in ways that were nondescript. Bathing suits in a few instances, sports clothing in a few others. And we asked them to describe the people who were self-assured and aggressive and successful and felt confident. Now, I assure you, the fellow with a PhD or the fellow became an attorney or the fellow became a doctor from a blue-collar background really thinks quite a bit of himself. And the woman who did it thinks quite a bit of herself. They really have a lot of self-assurance. I made it, and boy, I'm pretty good. The people who from upper middle class backgrounds who dropped out of high school really had very low opinions of themselves. But the fact remains, when these people looked at those videotapes, they picked the people from upper middle class backgrounds as being self-assured. What they were really identifying was socioeconomic body language and verbal patterns. Now, I'm going to make everyone out there look successful in exactly, unless you're driving a car, of course, in exactly 1 minute. First of all, if you're a man, brace your shoulders as if you went to West Point. Straighten up. That's right. Completely stiff as a board. That real West Point look. Now, without letting your shoulders slump, relax. Whether you're seated or standing, you can do it. You can't look stiff, but you have to look erect. If you can maintain, do that to yourself 20 times a day. At the end of 6-7 days, you'll begin to be a bit more erect. At the end of 2 days, you'll have a stiff back. If you're a woman, you may have to do the same thing, but most women stand erect enough. Oh, by the way, it's the angle of a man's shoulders that count. He can bend his head over any way, his neck or head over any way he wants. Al Haig is always bent forward bulldog, but his shoulders are straight. He's definitely in charge. Now, with women, however, the message system is almost entirely in the neck and head muscles. You see, when women hit 14, two things happen. They begin to wear high heels, and they become aware of their bodies, both which makes most of them stand erect. If a woman it doesn't stand erect, you have to practice it. But assuming you're in the 80-90% who do, then all you have to do is imagine there's a book on your head. Put your finger under your chin and push up until that book begins to slide back, exactly at that second stop. And if you can practice carrying your head in that manner, you'll get better seats in restaurants, you're more likely to be hired, and so on. Now, if you're going for a job interview this afternoon, don't try to do it because you'll look stiff and artificial. But if you're going in 2 weeks, if you practice for 2 weeks, you can very definitely double or triple your chances of making a positive impression upon these people. That's the object of the book, to teach people to do something specific, to get them a job, to get a promotion. Are things on office politics, you know, all these books on cutting people's throat is the way to get ahead? It's not. The way to get ahead is to make a friend of your boss. That's find a mentor. They call it in industry, the term is find a rabbi. Find someone up front, top, who's going to take care of you. Do so much work for them and be so cooperative with them, when they get a promotion, they take you along. That's the key to getting ahead. All these books on knifing people in the back are just plain hogwash and counterproductive.
How did you get into the success business?
By accident. I was a school teacher, and I started researching how the teacher's clothing affected the learning process in the classroom. The money was cut off mid-research project, but I had all this research, and nobody wanted it. And at least no one in education wanted it. Law firms hired me, and they were so happy with my packaging their attorneys to be more successful and more credible with juries that they recommended me to their clients. Corporations who who do pay very well, and politicians who don't. I now only work for corporations. And it grew from there. It grew Itopsy. I became involved first in clothing. And once you start studying clothing, you start studying when clothing works, how it's effective in administration, how it's effective in sales. So you become become involved in the research on power. You know, we were dressing people so they could give orders more effectively. Well, we had to study the nature of giving orders, and that we became involved in that. My next book is on sales. That's because in order to dress people to sell, you had to study sales. There was just no way of doing it. And to my surprise, I found that no one had done any research in the field worth a hoot.
When people dress for sales, do they dress differently than if they're trying to get up in the managerial world of a corporation?
It depends on what they're selling. If they're selling they're selling important things to high corporate officials, really not. You know, if you're selling computers to the head of IBM, you know, I pick IBM, head of General Motors, undoubtedly not. But if you're selling used cars, you don't want to wear a three-piece pinstripe suit. The whole point is to have a unified message. The real message of the book is this is the way the winners do it. If you want to be taken as a winner and have a better chance of winning, this is the way you may do it. By the way, all these success books I read about, they all promise instant success. Read this book and get ahead. I know it probably won't encourage too many people to buy my book, but it isn't going to work with my book. There's no easy, instant way. If you come from a blue-collar background as I do, you're going to have to work at it and work like blazes. You're going to have to practice walking differently, carrying your shoulders differently, holding your facial muscles differently. And if you're as unfortunate as I am and have an accent that doesn't work and have a tinny ear too so you can't really hear the differences, you're going to work and work at something you won't be able to correct. I've been trying with little or no success. Someone told me if I keep trying, it automatically will come to me one day, but I have doubts about that. But the fact is, the plain, simple fact is, the book is going to set out a course of work for you. It is not going to give you instant, easy success. It is going to give you a series of exercises you can follow to improve your image. The only positive side of the book is if you do it, your children won't have to.
When your working day is over and you're home alone or with your family, whoever, do you ever laugh at all of this? Does it ever strike you as being a touch absurd?
Oh, yes, it does. It always often strikes me as being absurd. I was driving along the street one day with my wife, and I hadn't shaved in a couple of days. We were coming down from the mountains, and my wife she wanted me to shave a little bit. I was looking rather gruffy, and she looked at me, and she rolled down the car window. There were two young women in skirted suits out there. She said, "Look at him, and he put you in suits." And but it does. First of all, the whole thing is sort of absurd. It's absurd that the world judges you the way it does. I don't comment on the absurdity of the world. I simply comment on you know, since the world is incorrect and somewhat immoral and prejudiced and absurd, this is the best way to handle it. It's not a comment. It's not a defense of the idiocy which makes my research so valuable. In fact, it's simply a comment that the idiocy is there. It's silly to judge a person's intelligence by the way they dress or by the way they hold their heads, but people do it all the time, and most people do it. And the only thing sillier than that is not taking advantage of the knowledge that's in the book. The only thing that is more counterproductive than is to ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist.
How about this? I don't know if this is a conceivable thing, but do you think there would be the possibility of educating people who make decisions on hiring and advancement into reading a different set of body language?
No. Let me tell you why. All my research proves is Pavlov was right. You know, we've been conditioned by our society. If every time you turn on the television, if I told everyone out there to close your eyes and to picture a big politician, governor, anyone on the air, not your governor you don't know, that mythical governor in a state you can't picture, you're going to picture a man. You're going to picture a man 55. You're going to picture a man in a conservative suit. You're going to picture a man who has a rather masculine ways about him. You're going to have all of these images, whether it's true or not, that's the image. And if a man fits that perception, he has a better chance of getting ahead. It's as simple as that. There's no way of reconditioning us not to be human. All I'm saying is we're human beings, and that we're affected by our environment. Now, and telling people how to use it affect the environment to their advantage instead of disadvantage.
You have some advice to people who have spouses that are going to be attending office functions with them, particularly dinners and parties. I've heard some of the advice for corporate wives. Is there enough of a pattern yet where you would give advice to corporate husbands?
Not really. There's general patterns. The one you can guess at. The corporate husband who is preferred by the corporation, however, is not the man that every woman might want to marry. He is number one. Well, they want someone. They want him to have the same abilities that the wife has, only in on the other side of the extreme. They want him to carry on, be able to attend a social affair, you know, not disgrace himself for, you know, carry on normal conversation. They want him, in addition, to be. They don't want him to interfere with her career. Now, in the same way they didn't want her to interfere with his, let me explain something. Corporation X, and I won't name it, but this is a lot of corporations. They'll hire you, and they'll have this big sign outside, "We promote women." And they do. They do. They give women every break in the world, and they want their women to succeed. However, if a successful woman is married to one of their men, it's going to hold him back because they know there can be a career clash there. You have to move to Detroit. She has to move to Chicago. If it's a divorce, he goes down the tubes for 2 years. And if there is no divorce, you have this tremendous conflict going on. So a successful husband in a conflicting career will hold back your career and you'll hold back his. Therefore, when a wife shows up at a party, if someone says to you, and you're a career woman, you know, "Do you enjoy working already?" You don't say, "I'm going to work there the rest of my life. I would never do anything else." You say, "Well, yes, for the time being." Giving the impression that wherever your husband goes, you're going to go along, because your job there is to be the dutiful camp follower. In the same way, if your husband goes to a party and he's a writer, and the man said to him, "Well, your boss says to him, 'By the way, you enjoy your wife's work. Oh, I'm so proud of her and terrific. And I'd go anywhere because, you know, I can make my living anyway.'" And they don't want him to be a bum, but they want him to have a job where he's mobile. So it isn't always the things that it's cracked up to be. The other thing they found is, you know, it's not fair for women. The rules for being an executive wife are just god-awful. And a lot of the women who are executive wives and who play the game hate it, but they know enough to do it. And I talked to them, and they said, yes, there are rules. You can drink, you know, one drink, period. You have to dress upper middle class and conservatively. You have to know which are the hot issues in your industry. For example, work with Atomic Energy. Don't say your husband works in Atomic Energy, don't carry a Jane Fonda button, or, you know, obvious things. But there can be subtle little things. A wife has to keep up with the politics in her husband's industry. Let me give you an offhand example. Suppose I don't happen to think recently somebody leaked some of Haig's personal conversations, okay? I happen to think that interferes with the function of government. I really do. I think the people in Washington have to have a private place to talk. Okay? But if my wife worked for a major broadcasting company, I don't know if I'd go in and say that in front of her boss, because he may be a diehard freedom of speech fellow. Now, I believe in one, but I wouldn't even, why start a fight?
So the best thing for you would be to not bring up the subject.
Not bring up the subject, or if they do bring it up, just you know, don't bother to get involved. Well, I don't know about that. I haven't, you know, don't get involved in it. It can be something that I'm sure a lot of people in industry would probably agree with me that they didn't think that should be leaked. I'm in the media. I write a column. But the fact is, some wouldn't, so why bother to bring it up? It can be sometimes very tenuous little things.
Who are some of the clients that you've had, or what kinds of clients have you had? I know you've done consulting for corporations, for individuals as well?
Well, I don't do individuals anymore. I don't have time. What we do is we do strictly consulting for corporations. We go in and, I spend about a percent of my time on college campuses now. One of my big sets of clients are business schools, you know, but I won't go into that. We speak before them. We teach their young people how to get into industry and what have you. But the clients that I have vary. They go from the major corporations mainly to law firms, accounting firms, and I teach them the nonverbal elements of selling. For example, your husband's an attorney and he goes to a party. There are five attorneys that go to the party. Everybody at the end of the party says, "Boy, he must be a sharp attorney." The other four, they don't remember. They don't know anything about his ability as an attorney. They're making judgments about something they don't know. But we know how he can sell himself as an attorney. We teach people how to sell themselves socially, how to fun studies. How to sell it at dinner. You remember you talked about that steak? If I'm selling to you and you're eating steak, it's tough because when you're chewing, you can't hear me. I have to know at exactly what point in the meal I can make my... If I have to sell while you're eating, I have to know when to make my critical points. I have to know how much to drink and when to... Very interesting studies. A lot of fun. I enjoy what I do.
There are agencies whose job is to dress so as to fit in with the indigenous population, and I'm thinking here of the FBI, for instance, or the CIA.
Oh, if they're the sending FBI people out to has another one country. Of the best nonverbal studies programs in the country.
What do they do for research? I spoke to them, but
most of their stuff has to do with criminals. You see, they tend to be studies of most people they deal with are psychopaths. So their studies of the criminals looking at them is not really. Their studies are of criminal nonverbals. They're particularly interested in negotiation, which is a, not negotiation, interrogation, which is really a form of sales. So I've discussed it with them, and I've spoken to them, but our fields, although related and they touch next to each other, really don't touch on top of each other. I did several columns on how policemen can go undercover, though. That was fascinating because the policemen stood out like sore thumbs. Uh-huh. And the way we picked the uniforms for them to go undercover is we had them grab a couple of their criminal friends and had them pick their clothing to disguise them. It was fascinating. Really fun.
Is that what you recommend police do now?
Yes.
Do they do that?
Several do, yes. We've been coming up with undercover uniforms because most policemen, I spotted them. I was outside Columbia waiting for my wife one day, and these two fellas are sitting down in the corner lolling in a car. I said, they're cops. I didn't know why they were. They could have had a sign out. They had sneakers on. They look like cops. They look grungy, but they look like cops. And sure enough, they were. And across the street, there were two medical students. I said, they look like medical. Now, why couldn't those two fellas shave and put on a tie? The perfect disguise near a college for young fellas would have been medical student, and medical students and interns have a different look than scroungy cops. Everybody knew, they would have blended in. But if I were criminal, I wouldn't have done anything criminal near that place.
What advice would you have for President Reagan about how he's dressing?
Well, I think he's such a master of the media that he's for me to give Reagan advice is like telling Michelangelo how to paint. It really isn't efficient. Although I cut out wearing that brown suit at press conferences. That isn't a great idea.
What about the Western garb for press conferences by his ranch?
Well, you see, he's got two images. Terrific. He's got one, the serious president, and the other, Mr. Nice Guy. I mean, Reagan, I mean, I don't advise Reagan. I study him. He's really terrific.
What about Nancy Reagan? She's
Nancy Reagan has problems. Nancy Reagan doesn't handle it at all well, and she's got lousy advice to go with them.
What's the bad advice?
Oh well, to start off with this high fashion look with nothing else but her job isn't to look good. You see that? Let me get Nancy Reagan. This is very important. Most women in industry say my job is to look as nice as I can, and Nancy Reagan believes that. No, her job is to look like the president's wife, and that's different. You see, she's making the mistake the women who wear fashion to industry are making, identical mistake. She isn't dressing for the job. She dresses always to send the same message. Well, concern and high fashion isn't the same message. If Nancy Reagan brought me in within a year, she wouldn't be getting brickbats. Well, she might get a few. She's already built up that image where they're throwing rocks at her. But she could really improve her image with not too much difficulty.
If you were her wardrobe consultant, what would she be wearing?
Oh, well, first of all, she'd still wear the things she wears that look good on her on those occasions when looking good is the name of the game. But would you like Nancy Reagan better if she showed up looking a little scruffy one day? Sure, you'd like her better. She'd be human. She's always perfect. Every hair in place, she's just too... Most women aren't that way. I mean... Cool it a little. She's a nice-looking woman for age. She can carry it off. But, you know, come down. I couldn't tell you exactly what. I take 10 garments, put them on, take pictures of her in various outfits. I say, okay, this works here. And we test them. But the fact is, it's surprising that she has such poor advice.
What about the China? Because you've spent a lot of time talking about how to behave at the table. And you also go into in your book
I don't think the China really would have caused a problem except for the other image. Mm-hmm. You had the hype. You know, after all, her answer wasn't very good. She should have said, the United States, if she had come out and said, look, I wanted to, something to the effect that I wanted to give the United States, this is my gift to the American people, it would have automatically taken a sting out of it. You know, I think her getting the China was a good idea myself.
Really? Why?
We didn't pay for it. The taxpayer, she got it from a rich friend. It's a terrific idea. She wants to buy us some new silver. I'm going to do that too. I mean, I think it's a great idea. In fact, I think they should refurbish the White House and they can start on my house.
They probably won't.
I have a sneaky feeling they won't. But they could refurbish the White House. Suppose every president that got in had more things put in by his, you know, contributions. Terrific idea.
Well, we're about out of time, but I have one more question for you. You say that bow ties are a sign of incompetence. I thought they were a sign of old money.
No, well, they might be in certain cases, but they become a sign of incompetence. Take a look at your TV characters. Let's see. On Bonnie Miller, there's the old... let's run through them. On Bonnie Miller, there's the retired chief. He wears a bow tie. He doesn't know what's going on. He comes in. Inspector Luga. On WKRP, it's the fellow who gives the hog reports. He wears the bow. He's also an incompetent. On that, there's a doctor's show where the old doctor wears bow ties. He's also incompetent. He's the doctor who can't perform. Night calls, house calls, something like that, okay? All of the people, it's become the flag of the incompetent.
But can you watch TV for an indication of how people think as if we based all our images on TV?
Well, no, the point is TV didn't create the image. TV simply, the people on TV are very... By the way, the people who package it, do the costume on TV are superb. Uh-huh. And a lot of them read my work and write to me and...
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
Tell us some of the letters you've gotten.
Oh, I can't.
Oh, you couldn't.
No, I don't talk about people who write to me, but they write to me and say, I read this and I tried it and I liked it. And WKRP, I did an article for TV Guide, and they just had a thing on where they dressed up the salesman who looks like a lout, you know, and they dressed him up in something and it didn't work because it didn't fit his personality. I wish they'd call me ahead of time. I could have helped them with it.
John Malloy, thanks for talking with us. It's been interesting to have you back.
Why, thank you very much. And I hope that the object of the book is to help somebody, not to make them feel badly. Right?
Okay. John Malloy is the author of a number of books, including Dress for Success, the Woman's Dress for Success book, and most recently, Malloy's Live for Success. And that's just been published in paperback. It's 21 minutes to 3 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. And coming up in a couple of minutes, we'll be meeting Danny Lyon, whose one-man show of photographs opens Saturday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. This is Louis Armstrong.
Got brand new suit, got a brand new tie. Got a brand new twinkle in my eye. Do you know the reason why? Got a brand new girl, and I want this view. She's the reason why. Got a brand new tie in a brand new suit. When I'm with her, gotta look my best. Put on my tan shoes, gray spats, double-breasted vest. Gonna wear my stick pin, the T-clap oil, with the brand new tie, the brand new girl. Thank you.
though my heart is broken, I always act gay. I just let them think I'm joking. It's better that way. My heart is aching, but no one will know. Clowning and joking, here's the way I go. I'm all dressed up with a broken heart, just like an actor that plays the part. I'm playing the role of a Jekyll and Hyde, an unhappy soul that keeps smiling outside. This world's a stage and we're all in a show. There's no applause for the loser, you know. So with my chest up, I go all dressed up with a broken heart.
Connie Boswell's recording of All Dressed Up with a Broken Heart, and we heard Louis Armstrong's recording of Got a Brand New Suit. It's 2:45. This is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Coming up at 4 o'clock today on the Island Farrell series, we'll be hearing part two of Bobby Short's guest appearance. On February 27th, which is this Saturday, the Philadelphia Museum of Art will open a show called Danny Lyon, Pictures from the New World. It's the first major exhibition of photographs at a museum by Danny Lyon. He seems to be leading the kind of life that many young documentary photographers aspire to. Since the mid-60s, he's traveled around the United States and Latin America, recording images of social movements, individuals, different countries. In the mid-60s, he was the staff photographer for SNCC. In 65, he traveled through Chicago, where he began photographing motorcyclists and eventually joined the Chicago Outlaw Motorcycle Club with the intention of making a book about them, which he did under the title The Bike Riders. The next year, he traveled to Columbia with his camera. In 67, he headed back to his native New York, where he photographed some of the buildings in Lower Manhattan slated for demolition and hung out with the men who were in the demolition crews and photographed them as well. That same year, he got permission from the Texas Department of Corrections to photograph the prison and the prisoners. 10 years later, when an inmate sued the Texas Department of Corrections, Lyon was asked to be a witness on behalf of the inmates. During most of the 70s, his home was based in New Mexico, and he started making documentary films. He's still making documentary films. He now lives in New York, and one of his recent series of still photographs have been subway photos. In conjunction with this show of still photographs at the museum, his films will be shown. For more information about the screenings, you can call PO38100. And the first screening will be on March 2nd, and that will be El Otro Lado, which translates to The Other Side, March 9th and 14th, Los Niños Abandonados, the Abandoned Children, March 30th and April 4th, Little Boy, and April 6th and 11th, Dear Mark. And we'll be hearing a little more about these films. But you can call PO38100 for more information about the screenings. Danny Lyon, welcome to Fresh Air. I enjoyed your work, and it's nice to meet you. You've traveled all around with your still camera, and I guess with a moving picture camera as well. What makes you decide what it is you want to photograph or film?
I don't know. I mean, I know. I don't know what makes me decide. You just know, you know. It's like falling in love.
You know, there's times when I've been traveling where I've almost wished that I was a photographer or something, because it in a way would give a certain purpose to your trip that you don't have if you're just traveling. I mean,
yeah,
your
right.
purpose
I had
is
a big
enjoyment,
fight
but...
with Nancy in the Yucatan or someplace, because it wasn't the Yucatan, but we were in Mexico and we were going to look at a ruin. And I, at one point, she used the word tourist, and I started raving. I wasn't a goddamn tourist, you know. And of course, I was a tourist, but I could pretend I wasn't because I was a photographer.
Right. I guess I'm starting to get comfortable with the word tourist. I'm trying to accept the fact that I am here out of curiosity, and I want to. Yes, I want to see the buildings I haven't seen before and eat at the restaurant.
Well, I like riding on the train from New York to Philadelphia. I like looking at the buildings in Philadelphia. Does that make me a tourist? I've just never been here that much.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Right,
you know?
Right. You've done all those photographs recently on the New York subways, and I'm a native New Yorker, and I've never known where to look when I'm on the train. You know that mm-hmm. everybody looks at each other at the ass.
I think to... I was on the subway today. In fact, I took the subway to Penn Station, you know. And, of course, the subway was a lot more interesting than the people on the train. You know, I guess it's a class thing. But I think to look at the subway aesthetically, you can't ride it every day. I mean, if you're riding to work and you have to use the subway, it can be an absolutely horrible experience, you know. People are tired and depressed. Their children aren't on it, mostly working people and single people. And people who have no place to live, and all kinds of people are thrown together there. But if you're not on it all the time and you go there just to look, where else could you go to see what's the world and the New York subway? It's unbelievable. You take a car at random, you talk about humanity or a section of the world, you know. Look what's in that car. Look around, you know. I got in a cab in New York. It was pretty late at night, and... I started talking to her. The driver was Latin, and we'd both grown up in the city, but I'd grown up in Queens, and my father was a physician, and he was Latin and grew up in the Bronx, and probably, you know, on a much smaller income than my family lived on. And we had both traveled, and we both come back all over the world, and we both came back to New York, and he said, "There's no place like New York, man. New York is a modern Rome." And he said that city was where it was at, that he had been all over the world and he had seen everything. He'd seen Asia and Africa, but there was no place like the city, you know. And I think that's true. It's one of the most exciting cities that ever existed, you know.
Did you have to leave it to feel that way?
I got to leave it right now to feel that way. I think living there is absolutely horrible, you know. I have three children. It's a murderous experience. The lack of relief, the inability to dig a hole in the ground, you know, Jefferson couldn't stand being in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia then was probably something like Santa Fe, New Mexico was 30 years ago. It was hardly anything here, and he still couldn't stand it. I grew up in Queens, surrounded by pavement. It's murder to be in Manhattan. Yeah, I think we all need to see the birds and look at a rose and plant something, and it's just terribly difficult on us all to be so separated from nature, you know, from gardening. I think the happiest place that I've ever been is my garden out in New Mexico.
You know, looking at your photographs and reading about places that you've been, I figured that you must have the ability to fit in with really different kinds of people. And I was trying to imagine if I could have joined a biker's mm-hmm. club and done a series on them. I mean, obviously I couldn't have.
I think I do, and I like it. I like people a lot, you know. Some people are like that. There's no question that that's part of it, you know. People have looked at the Abandoned Children, which is about abandoned children in Colombia, you know. I mean, I not only did I make the film in 3 weeks, I couldn't even speak Spanish when I did it, and people see the film, and I think they think I spent years with these children, you know, and And someone said to me that what was good about the film was what I evoked in these children, you know. I mean, they were reacting to me. On the one hand, I was, they called me the good gringo, the bueno gringo, you know, the good gringo. I surprised them that an American or a white man or someone of my class would pay that much attention to them and treat them as equals, which, you know, I don't, not only felt they were equals, I felt way beneath them, because I think if you are an American and share the power of this country and you share the guilt of this country and you see and you share the misery of this country, and then you see people who have nothing, and these children have nothing. I mean, they called a manhole cover in the middle of the street the officina, and they kept a couple of pieces of string in there. That was their possessions, and they ate by handouts. And they somehow, from my watching them, they seemed to have something that we had lost, you know. It's a terrible thing to say about us, but it's true, you know. They had somehow remained in childhood. They seemed to experience friendship and happiness and love of each other in a way that probably most educated white people can't do, you know. That's a terrible condemnation of our country, sad to say.
Is that the kind of response you want people to have when watching your film, for instance?
I think they should just have whatever response they want, including getting angry at me. You know, a Colombian guy practically threatened me to a duel after seeing that film.
Yeah, about what?
He said, what for you come to my country to make this film, you know? And he was absolutely right. Why didn't I make it in New York? And New York's supposed to have tens of thousands of abandoned people.
It does.
I don't think I made the film in 72, 10 years ago. I don't think I would make that film today. I know I wouldn't.
Why not?
I'd make it in Manhattan.
Could you do that? Would you? Making it in Manhattan would mean living by the tracks of the subways, living in the toilets in the train stations.
I didn't live with those children. I lived in a nice hotel with air conditioning, a beach in front.
You came out and filmed during the day.
I just went out and doing my work, you know. It's work to me. It's a work the same as your work is, or someone going to the office. I go off and work, you know, put on my hat and go down to the local whorehouse or motorcycle gang or my parents' graveyard and work. You know?
Do you dress differently if you're shooting the motorcycle gang than if you're shooting street kids?
I dress like I am.
Just like?
I should say I don't dress differently because I'm on the radio.
You knew we'd be talking about dressing for success.
I don't know. I guess I'm getting too old for this, but I don't know. I never cared that much about it, I think.
But I was wondering, like, if people want to think that you're like them, so that if you're dressing, like, if you're going to meet the bikers, if they want to think that,
well,
that
when
you
I
like
was
leather
with
jackets.
Them, I had them. First of all, I was 10 or 15 years younger when I was in the Chicago Outlaws. And I had a Triumph motorcycle and drove it around, and that's what led to it. I met these people in mechanic shops and things like that, you know.
You know what's strange? I've seen this in some bikers and seen it also in the photographs that you took of bikers. There's something, you may think I'm crazy for this, but there's something really strange in some of their eyes.
In their eyes?
Yeah, this really strange look. I don't know. Sounds,
put my photographs,
sounds weird, doesn't
or,
it? Yeah, yeah. Well,
or, people in the street.
Well, also people I've ran into, like in diners and stuff. Sounds crazy, huh?
No, I mean, it doesn't. I mean, we look like what we are. Or, you know, it's easy if you've been around prisons. It's pretty easy to identify someone who's been in a prison, whether you meet them in the subway or in a cocktail party. Their gestures and tattoos and marks and the way people talk and stuff. Identify them immediately to each other and to anybody who really knows about it well enough, you know.
When you're photographing people, do they usually want to look a certain way for the photograph? I mean, do they have an idea of what a good photograph will be and want to pose that way for you?
I don't ask them.
Yeah.
And I know photographers talk that way, and I don't really think about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that interested in photography, if you can understand that.
You're interested in the stuff.
I'm interested in people.
That makes the
photograph. Probably the way you are. Anyway, I'm interested in people, I think. I studied history. I kind of fell into photography. And when I because the earliest thing that I did that really reached the public was the civil rights movement, it was a way of affecting things. It was at first a way for me to participate in an event of tremendous excitement at the time, And it was a way for a white person to be in what was really a black organization, because the few whites in SNCC at that time were people who had special talents. I mean, it was, they argued, why have Dorothy Miller here? You know, well, Dorothy Miller could type, or Dorothy Miller was educated, could write a press release. Therefore, she's allowed. But if a black woman could do the same job, there was really no reason to have that a white person in there, because the whole point of the revolution was to improve the things in the South. And you didn't do that by having white people lead black people. I was used because I was a better photographer than anybody else at the time around there. And when other photographers showed up and a lot of people started doing it, I stopped doing it. I stepped aside, you know.
I think it was with the civil rights movement that the idea of the whole world is watching came into being, that if protests were getting brutalized by the police, that it would be carried on network television, or the photographs would appear in the newspapers.
The whole world was not watching. At first, by the time the whole world was watching, the civil rights movement had won a significant victory, and it had reached a plateau that it never really left. You know, that moment was the demonstrations of Birmingham, Alabama, when the photographs were taken of people being hit by fire hoses and dogs used on protesters. That situation was so dramatic and so lended itself to photography. That reached everybody, and at that point it became a national event, you know, in the media. I was at the University of Chicago in the library when that happened, because I had been involved in the movement and was still in school. I was trying to finish out school, but before that, the civil rights movement was just the kind of way in the back burners. You know. Things are so different now, you know. Really, we even a minor incident with now, all kinds of press would converge on it. So many dramatic things happened then that weren't filmed, you know. When you think that in of the things that happened in 62 that didn't have sync sound movie crews and it wasn't really covered, it's incredible the way people now, you know, just descend on these things.
Did your presence with a camera ever diffuse potential brutality?
Yeah, they hit me instead of the demonstrators.
But there wasn't...
I remember a time John Lewis was being beaten in front of me, and John and I were roommates in Atlanta. And I was a, you know, the white son of a physician, a German immigrant physician in New York. He was the son of a black minister from Troy, Alabama, and a minister himself. I'm Jewish. I mean, we couldn't have been more different, but I think that was one reason we were so attracted to each other. I mean, just the way he talked would make you fall on the ground and be in love with the guy. Lincoln was popular because of that when he came east, because he was a Southerner and people were spellbound listening to this country guy talk. Well, yeah, John, I was supposed to be the photographer, and he was carrying a placard. And actually, I think there was a confrontation. There was a Ku Klux Klan march out in the open, which always seemed kind of ridiculous to me, but I was never afraid of the Klan, you know. Anyway, they jumped on him, or police did, and he was being beaten, and I was supposed to photograph, and it was really terrible. I felt terrible.
Did you photograph it?
I don't know what I did. I probably took a couple bad pictures. Yeah, my job was to take photographs. That was my job, you know. I was not supposed to be arrested, you know. People like John had been arrested 30 times. You know, SNCC workers prided themselves on their arrest records. I wasn't supposed to be arrested. Julian Bond, I worked in the office. Julian Bond was one of the people who worked there. Dorothy Miller, who was white and worked there. We were supposed to turn our propaganda. It was the SNCC propaganda office. We were supposed to avoid arrest so we could come back with these pictures and text and write these things up, try to get them out to the press. The pictures were used on posters. They were used for fundraising. At one point, they were presented in Congress, pictures I took, and resulted in the release of these young girls in prison who were just in these atrocious conditions, and I snuck in and took pictures of them. I'm sure it was all very exciting at the time. I think those things are happening now in Salvador in a much more deadly kind of game, you know.
Yeah, so, well, some of the journalists down there have been shot or have been killed. Were you ever in a position of knowing that you were risking your life for your photos?
Oh, I know. I'm sure I've risked my life a lot of times. At that time in the South, I was 21 or 22 years old. I didn't want to die, you know. I certainly didn't want. I was absolutely terrified of being beaten in a prison or something like that. I was arrested a couple times. I remember pissing in my pants when I was surrounded by these policemen threatening me. I mean, it's absolutely terrifying. I would run. I didn't want my head busted open. I mean, I didn't have any problems, macho kind of problems about those things. I mean, I think that I had a policeman pull out a gun and say he was going to blow his head off because I was a white man in a black neighborhood. And I said my mother was black and my father was black. I said the wrong thing and he went totally crazy. You're supposed to say your mother is black. You see, under segregation, you can be in a black neighborhood if you're black, you know. I mean, that's the whole idea of it. And this was in rural Mississippi around 1962. And I was trying to reach SNCC workers, and there was nobody white. I mean, the white people were in the white part of town, and the transition was very difficult. I object to this in the sense that it kind of glorifies me a little bit. In fact, of course, there were young people and unknown people, people who didn't go on to be famous photographers, who were much more courageous than I ever was, who were subjected to beatings and all kinds of horrors. And people, of course, were killed, you know. Anyway, I told him I was black, you know. And he didn't care. He told me to get out of town or I'd kill him. He'd kill me. You know? So I left town the next day. I couldn't wait to get out of there.
So does it seem to you that photographs
When the bullets started flying, which they did in Cambridge, Maryland, and then late, by 64, people were shooting and the blacks were getting much more militant. SNCC workers would... I drove down from New York to Mississippi with a SNCC worker. He had a gun on him. I was shocked, you know. When the bullets started flying, you know, you'd hear these pop, pop, and... I didn't like it, you know, the idea that you could be hit from far away and not, you know, when a man's going to beat you and you can look at him in the eye, you can make some kind of judgment of it and you can back off, you know. But, I mean, to get shot by mistake or something, I didn't want to die. And that's why I didn't go to Vietnam. I always felt I would be killed. I think 30 or 40 journalists were killed there. There were other things I wanted to do in life. You know.
You've done a lot of your photographs because the things that you were photographing were important to you politically. They were important political statements or statements about social change that you wanted to make. And in fact, your photographs have been used to give testimony supporting an inmate, for instance, in Texas who was suing the Texas prison system. Does it seem to you, having been doing this for about 20 years, that photography and films are in fact an effective way of making a statement? And do you feel that you can reach people through visual representations of things who might mm-hmm. not have otherwise been reached?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, on the one hand, when you say, well, having done it for 20 years, I know I ought to be doing something else, you know. There's not a really much of an excuse to do the same thing for 20 years. We have so little time which to do with our lives, you know. I like to think of myself as a product of this country that exercised the freedom given to me, not only politically but economically, you know. I'm always kind of horrified at Americans who throw away their lives in return for some kind of a steady paycheck. I think that's really horrible, you know. They're not going to get another life. And if they want to spend it by the pool with the color TV, I think that's just sad. You know, there's so much more to do in this world. As far as reaching people, it's very hard to reach people through films. You know, there just isn't the setup. It's just so different than photographs and books. Books, you can get the books out and people can buy them and take them home and keep them. You've probably never seen any of my films, and you may never see any of my films. The chance of seeing them at the museum is a rare one, and in that sense, I urge you to go to some of the showings if you can. It's just a different world. I think the equivalent of publishing photographs for films is probably television, and we're just all locked out of it as far as you know, any kind of national television. PBS wouldn't deal with my film about the Colombian children, although I consciously made it at a time thinking this was the right film to show Americans at that time in 1972. I wouldn't. Now I feel differently about it. I would prefer to make a film right now. I'm trying to. No one might ever see that film. I don't know what will happen to it. Maybe it'll get shown in New York a couple times and that'll be it, which is very different from the books. In the books, there's a different kind of problem. I published a book earlier than this myself called The Paper Negative, which was a much more radical book in a way, because I didn't have to argue with a publisher about it. I didn't have to answer people's questions or try to explain why I did something. You know, I could simply do the work as I believed in it, you know. But getting those things published and getting them distributed is a whole another thing, you know. We often talk with friends about publishing them, getting really the finest things are just not, they don't get into print. It's just, you know, people with companies and the money to finance the printings of these books are they're not exactly radicals, and you can't blame them. They don't want to take the 30 or 40 grand and use it to produce an individual's work of art, you know?
What are radical images that you think wouldn't be accepted?
Well, it isn't the particular pictures. I don't think that's a problem. There's actually been a lot of progress. When The Bike Riders was done, a picture of a gangbang was just absolutely out of the question. You know, the same pictures were published in this book, and no one would care less about it. So, I mean, there's no question things have changed that way. But I mean radical in the sense of an individual simply doing it the way he wants. You know, as soon as you step into the established world of publishing, people who are putting up the money are going to have their opinions, you know. There were huge fights over the cover, over this type. I said put the subway picture on the front, and Hoffman said that'll frighten people. No one will buy the book. I said this was a mess representation of what was inside it, and on and on and on. I think that it's fair enough for an artist to do what he wants. Isn't that why he became an artist in the first place?
Yeah, let me reintroduce you for our listeners who are just joining us. Danny Lyon is my guest, and he's a photographer and filmmaker. And a collection of his work from the 60s to the present is going to be on exhibit at the Philadelphia Museum of Art beginning this Saturday. And in conjunction with that exhibit, there'll be a kind of rare opportunity to see his films. There will be four different films showing on dates between March and April, and I'll give you a rundown a little later, but if you missed the rundown, you could call the Philadelphia Museum of Art for more information. It seems to me that in the early 70s, there was a lot more talk amongst documentary filmmakers than I hear now about how much you really need to know a person before you're capable of filming their lives, and to which, like, the camera will change their behavior, and are you getting them performing for the camera, or are you getting the camera really capturing what they do? Has that type of talk ceased? Or am I not listening in the right places?
I don't.
Do you think it's important to ask those questions?
No, yeah? I don't think it's important. I think it's a bogus issue. You know?
Do you? How come?
That picture's posed. I mean, by all the terminology you use, I mean, I took that picture the same way my father took pictures of his family 35 years ago. Go ahead.
It's a picture of Danny Lyon's family. His wife is walking in like a parka trench coat, and she's very pregnant. And alongside of her is their daughter, and a few steps behind them is their young son. And they're walking in what I guess is a New Mexican landscape?
I guess so, or in a Greco landscape. It's hard to tell, but... I just think, yeah.
It's a very serene kind of photograph.
I think you can do whatever. I mean, it's a picture that matters. I mean, how it came about, I don't. I think it might be of some kind of academic interest, but I don't care. If there's something that I love, I don't want to know the story behind it. It just ruins it. Do you want to know? Do you know what I mean? You don't want to tear it all apart. If you take The Execution of Song, I mean, if you like that book, it's quite a book, you know. I don't really want to see his notes or anything, and I think that's true of these pictures. You know?
Yeah, but when I'm watching a documentary, say particularly one on television, I want to know if I should believe what I'm seeing or not, whether it's behavior that was encouraged because it would make a good